You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
Lost Connections, Uncovering the Real Causes of Depression and the Unexpected Solutions by author Johann Hari. In its official statement for World Health Day in 2017, the United Nations reviewed the best evidence and concluded that, quote, the dominant biomedical narrative of depression is based on biased and selective use of research outcomes that must be abandoned. End of quote. We need to move from focusing on chemical imbalances, they said, to focusing more on power imbalances. After I learned all this and what it means for us all, I started to long for the power to go back in time and speak to my teenage self on the day he was told a story about his depression that was going to send him off in the wrong direction for so many years. I wanted to tell him thus. The pain you are feeling is not pathology. It's not crazy. It is a signal that your natural psychological needs are not being met. It is a form of grief for yourself and for the culture you live in going so wrong. I know how much it hurts. I know how deeply it cuts you. But you need to listen to this signal. We all need to listen to the people around us sending out this signal. It is telling you what is going wrong. It is telling you that you need to be connected in so many deep and stirring ways that you aren't yet, but you can be one day. This is the end of the message to his teenage self. John Hari then continues, if you are depressed and anxious, you are not a machine with malfunctioning parts. You are a human being with unmet needs. The only real way out of our epidemic of despair is for all of us together to begin to meet those human needs. For deep connection to the things that really matter in life.
Thank you, Hugh. Church in 21st century postmodern, post-industrial countries like ours is not what it used to be, and thus not what we may have come to expect from generations past. Church is, for one thing, a niche lifestyle activity. Absolutely essential for a few, peripheral to most. With only 15% of the population regularly attending some sort of worship during the week, it is clearly not as central to organizing most lives as it was a generation or two ago. Church used to be a way of organizing a shared worldview and values around a core text, and a process of continually mining and explicating that text for a wide and mixed audience. But rising literacy, mass public education through tertiary level, mass media, And the revolution in communication technologies have largely supplanted the educational function of church. Church was also a way, beyond education, of displaying wealth and social status, dressing in your Sunday best, giving generously and conspicuously, and even running churches and their related organizations and being around those people that did, used to be a way of making your way into a social network and up a social ladder. Most folks now rely on other means to display their wealth or social success, like real estate, private schooling, exclusive membership clubs, and so on. In the Christian tradition of the West, from which we're descended, the educational and social status functions of church stem not from Christian theology, but from Western culture. In the dying days of the Roman Empire, Constantine made Christianity the religion of the imperial elite, and so it spread as a way of keeping up with or rising above the Joneses, or Jonases, or Jonii. My Latin's a little faulty. And you can see that social climbing stuff played out right down to the 20th century in our own church's history and the displays of wealth and power of formerly wealthy families' gifts. Look at the back of the church, stunning artisanal stained glass memorials and a Force 12 organ. But few people now come to church to learn one brand of arcane textual wisdom that can only be explained by a professional, and few come now to show off social class anymore. So these remaining 15%, what do you think church offers them in our day? Much of contemporary ministry training is predicated on the notion that the services of church you will be administering will be administered to those who might be called vulnerable adults, and on making a community of those vulnerable adults functional and hopefully redemptive of that which has rendered them vulnerable. Simple, yes? By this reckoning, if a church now exists mainly to bind up the broken and marginalized as it did when it was invented for and among the socially dispossessed before Constantine, ministry is meant to have some sort of therapeutic effect, like counseling or life coaching. And this would mean good ministry shouldn't strive to keep vulnerable adults dependent on them, but help them become autonomous, spiritually healthy, cured of the affliction that brought them here, seeking, well, meaningful wholeness, which shares the same root as the word holiness. So our model client, if there is such a thing, is someone who grows beyond the need for ministry to hold them together and partakes in ministry to help hold others together. Not dependent on church, not independent of church, hopefully, but interdependent with church. Most of my pastoral attention, which includes public worship, is about making people feel better. Why? Because generally they somehow don't. They feel lost, socially isolated, guilt-ridden, self-defeated, failed, struggling, and hungry for meaning in their lives. In many ways, church is returning to the early first century model of small communities made from people who find themselves not at the top of the heap, but at the margins. Maybe at the margins of life itself. I mean, Jesus' actual practice, if you recall, was not to say, "Come to me, all you who are heavily labored and are burdened, and I will give you strict rules, complicated theology, and a bridge club." No. Jesus' message was, feed the hungry, comfort the afflicted, be with the imprisoned, gather in the lost. So maybe this mad project called church, this unacknowledged and underfunded halfway house for the vulnerable, has gone back to the future and is again, once again, what it was intended originally to be. Would you join with me in singing our second hymn, Comfort Me? Please stand as you're able. Thanks, Brendan. Religion means, remember, to bind up again. To bind up again. It follows that any therapeutic value of church comes through meaningful connectivity. This suggests that spiritual and mental health are not mutually exclusive domains, but share a rather large frontier. Mental health issues such as depression and anxiety are everywhere on the rise in cultures like ours, and it is time that churches put aside angels dancing on the head of a pin theological pedantry and faced up to how much of a frontier we share with mental health, although with different tools and approaches. I mean, if mental health is all just brain chemistry, then it's only the proper realm of clinicians and the billion-dollar international pharmaceutical industry, which I'm sure has your best interests at heart. But is mental illness not also a spiritual matter? Whence comes mental illness, and what can we do as churches to really be brothers and sisters? To really be our brothers and sisters' keepers and support each other on the journey. There is an old story that might illustrate what I think church communities can offer. This guy's walking down the street and he falls in a hole. The walls are so steep he can't get out. A doctor passes by the hole and he shouts up, "Hey doc, can you help me out?" Doctor looks into the hole, writes out a prescription for anxiety medication, throws it down the hole, moves on. Then a priest comes along and he shouts up, "Father, I'm down this hole, can you help me out?" Priest writes out a prayer and throws him an application to be baptized a Catholic, throws it down the hole, moves on. But he's in luck, this guy in the hole. Eckhart Tolle comes walking by. Guy in the hole says, "Oh, great, a real guru. Hey, Eckhart, mate, can you help me out?" Eckhart Tolle says, "Your problem is not that you are in a hole, but that you are not living in the present. You need to do more mindfulness training and accept that life is suffering." Guy says, "But I'm in the now, and the present moment really, really sucks. I could die down here." Well, Eckhart Tolle tosses a mindfulness DVD down the hole, climbs into his jet. Then a friend walks by. Guy in the hole says, "Hey Joe, it's me down here, can you help me out?" And the friend jumps into the hole. The guy says, "Are you crazy? Now we're both down here." The friend says, "Yeah, but I've been down here before. I know a way out." Modern life's full of these holes. And if you've noted the rising statistics on mental illness, more and more of us seem to be falling in. Why? If it's just chemistry, why would brains across the planet be increasingly spontaneously malfunctioning? Coincidence? Chemtrails? Russian hackers? Well, many leading scientists believe the whole idea that depression is caused only by a chemically imbalanced brain is wrong. There are 9 major causes of depression and anxiety. Only 2 are biological. 7 are out there in the world, not sealed away inside our skulls. The World Health Organization has been warning for years that we need to start dealing with the deeper causes of depression, and these deeper causes have to do with lost connection and loss of meaning. Depression is a symptom of a sick society. It is a disease of lifestyle, a disjunction between what we are in ourselves and how we have demanded that we live. And for a start, what are we? Humans are social creatures. Any anthropologist will tell you that working together was the catalyst for our planetary dominance as a species. So the more we're disconnected from others, the more we lose what makes us wholly human. It's not a mistake that solitary confinement's a form of torture. We are hardwired for tribal identity. And a further fact is that people with a strong tribal identity, like our hunter-gatherer ancestors, or indeed any tribal society today, though their lives may be nasty, disease-ridden, brutish, and short, hardly ever display signs of depression. Hardly ever. And of course, you and I have been adapting our behavior over the last two centuries to rapid industrial and post-industrial change, but our brains haven't had enough evolutionary time to alter the way they're basically built. Our evolution has not prepared us for the sedentary, indoor, socially isolated, sleep-deprived, work-insecure, frenzied pace of modern life. And this pace is getting more frenzied. I have had to say to not a few people in my care, would you stop blaming yourself for feeling strung out? You're not the problem. Life has become increasingly hard to deal with. There's less job security. There's still less meaningful work to do. We have less control over our lives. There's less community with all of us sequestered in our neurotic little single-family units. And there's more information out there than we can handle, and almost all of it bad news. And all that is if you've got your health. Most of the happy media messages are some form of advertising, where everybody is healthy, rich, beautiful, stylish, thin, happy, popular, and doing great, so why aren't you? Must be you. The whole of consumer economics relies on the creation of anxiety relievable only by purchase. And of course, you will never be able to buy enough. And if you're broke, you're really screwed. No wonder we feel isolated, even in company. No wonder we're drinking ourselves stupid and watching cat videos. See what I mean? Could you stop talking to Wild Rob? I'd just like to watch the cat video. We have made a slick, fast, glittering reality for ourselves, and we are finding it increasingly intolerable. Or tolerable only through medication, self-medication, and or denial. These, of course, address the symptoms, but not the causes. Ancient wisdom suggests that rather ignoring depression or buffering its symptoms, we should instead go further into it, to lean into it, as it is said today. The timeless myth of the hero's journey can be seen in this light. And that journey is, of course, on the surface, a geographical journey, but represents a journey into the psyche to find the authentic self, the hero or heroine inside. Fairy tales, Greek tragedies, the Christian myth, and other old stories all suggest that suffering, if confronted, can make us truly well, even wise. One famous story of such a journey is Dante Alighieri's Divine Comedy. The Divine Comedy charts the poet Dante's imaginary journey through hell, literally, then purgatory, and finally paradise. Like all great stories, it begins in the middle of someone's crisis. Nel mezzo del cammin della nostra vita mi ritrovai in una spera scura. In the middle of our life's journey, I became lost in a dark wood. For the straight path had been lost. To talk about it is hard. So tangled and rough and savage that thinking of it now renews the fear. Death is hardly more bitter. And yet to treat the good I found there as well, I'll tell you what I saw. Dante not only finds that he's lost, but in addition, he's being stalked by a leopard, a creature of that forest, so there's nowhere to hide. But a spirit guide appears to help him. The Roman poet Virgil, that's the two of them there, a kind of wise poet father representing wisdom. And like the friend in the story of the guy in the hole, Virgil can indeed show him the way out, but the only way out is inward and downward into the even darker depths of the earth itself, like death, through the labyrinthine architecture of the invisible inner world. And that's the sort of architecture of Dante's universe, hell, purgatory, and the various spheres of the heavens. Dante is first led into the darkest places of the human psyche, into hell itself with all its karmic punishments. Then the shadowy prison of purgatory with its desperate longing for release, and finally toward the great light. He describes coming into the presence of the light of God in a very curious way. He says, that living light on which I looked, which is always what it was before, was altering for me as I was changing, and seemed to be colored with our human likeness. So after his descent into darkness and his long and arduous and scary journey, he finds God, and God is kind of like a luminous mirror, changing in appearance as Dante himself is changed. If you would seek ultimate meaning and grace, the ancient wisdom seems to say, seek within. Much as all the great sages have said, Jesus said, the kingdom of heaven is within you, in books that were later helpfully cut from the Bible. When I first read the Divine Comedy as a green undergraduate, I was aware of the story's importance, and I knew what a myth and an allegory were, but it wasn't until the middle of my own life's journey, until I fell into a hole and hit its rock bottom, that I really got, not on an intellectual level, but on a human gut level, the wisdom of leaning into one's inner darkness and the importance of finding the right help on the way. Scary as it might be, the spiritual journey beats the hell out of an anesthetized life. My own middle came about 15 years ago, and I'm reminded of Dante's line, thinking of it now, I feel the old fear stirring, but to tell you of the good I found there as well, I'll tell you what I saw. I'd been having a running skirmish with boring old monopolar depression. I'd envy the bipolar because they get the excitement of the manic stuff, but boring old monopolar depression that had been dogging me for decades and for which I was happily medicated. Wrapped in the cotton wool of a daily dose of 150 milligrams of Effexor and temazepam. I did not think of myself as lost or broken or vulnerable, but outwardly and seemingly at the very peak of a highly functioning life, thank you. I was a tenured, award-winning senior lecturer at uni. I had a parallel career as an actor, also going well. I had a big property in Aldgate, an English sports car, the one I always wanted, in my driveway. I had a solid marriage, healthy, happy children, good friendships, financial security, robust health, peace and plenty forever beckoned, and then I tried to kill myself. One thing I know to be true, it is always and exactly when we think we are the most unassailable that we are in fact at our most vulnerable. And please, let us not glibly trivialize this middle as the fabled midlife crisis. The middle of our lives can come any time, because what we mean by the middle is the breaking point, a point in time which clearly separates who we were before we became ourselves and who we were after. Your middle is whenever you were the most challenged, most fearful, most crazy, most abject, most wanted to crawl under the earth, perhaps. And this is a kind of middle that can happen more than once. Though I didn't think of myself as vulnerable or in denial, I had been running away from my condition for, well, ever. Expatriate sounds so much sexier than drifter. Actor sounds so much cooler than shapeshifter. But in a space of a couple of months, a triggering event, both my parents died painfully, protractedly, and miserably. And suddenly, there was the dark wood, stalked, as I was, by one of the seven causes, one of which is childhood sexual abuse trauma I'd been avoiding and keeping from these parents. But now, there was nobody to pretend for anymore. So rather than face all the shame, the pain, the incomplete relationships, and a lifetime of coping mechanisms, a handy bottle of sleep medication seemed the tidy, obvious solution. So I swallowed the whole bottle and lay down. How am I still here? Funny story. I'm not a doctor, though I played one on TV once. So I didn't know it at the time, but my sleeping pills were really just muscle relaxants, so I didn't so much die as become a kind of large bag of overcooked linguine, all loose and floppy and dopey. Oh God, I wailed, I can't even do this right. Talk about a divine comedy. a dear friend came and decanted me into his car and then poured me into a private clinic, decanted like water at the lowest, most humiliated, most wretched point in my life. And I must say to you that it is the best thing that ever happened to this boy. As the clear-eyed writer Albert Camus said, there is only one truly serious philosophical question, and that is suicide. Judging whether life is or is not worth living amounts to answering the fundamental question of philosophy. And he's right. Every other question proceeds from choosing to go on living when you feel you're at an end. And this kind of middle always feels like an end, but it needn't be. A guy falls into a hole. What in that hole, in those dark woods, could help you make the choice to go on? What helped get me up and out was a journey with both clinical and spiritual dimensions. Continuing medication for a while had its place because it held me together long enough to get my wise poet father professional psychiatric help and follow-up counseling. But what mattered in the long run was neither of these. What mattered in the long run was precisely what the science of depression is discovering and something the world we've made for ourselves provides little of: meaningful connection. This is where church can and should and does play a role. I mean, I had a few friends, of course, and they were crucial, and you quickly figure out who the real ones are. But also, I came to this church a lot more. Not because I found answers here or therapy, but because it gave me the opportunity to connect with others in a meaningful context, in a context that's not home, that's not work, that's not commerce, a place where things that matter are deeply considered in community. I engaged with church more. I prayed hard. I listened deeply. And I was ultimately buoyed up by being part of a caring community. Now, caring community is not unique to this church, of course. I could have gone to any of the many. Finally, for me, it was a matter of your hospitality, your welcome, and a certain tone here that is most notable in our candles, when they are done in the proper spirit. Gradually, I found this sort of connectedness something worth devoting my new life to, or to throw it away on, depending on who you ask, and to offer the sort of opportunity for meaningful connection that helped save me, the kind that means you truly belong somewhere in a web of kindly connections that create human wholeness. But church communities made of delicate people are delicate things. If misunderstood or mishandled, church communities can do more harm than good. They can become cultish, insular, factional, exclusive, tribal in all the worst senses of tribal. But if handled correctly, church can literally help save lives, as this one did mine. You'll see on the pews we've put some flyers encapsulating a healthy approach toward pastoral relationships, those meaningful connections I speak of. There are more outside if you want to grab some. Read them, though. Read them in your understanding of this talk, because if you're only turning up here for the Sunday show, you're missing the real show. A show that can run as long as you do, which happens when people form caring relationships and allow themselves to know others and to be known by others. Well, such was the circuitous spiritual journey that led me where I stand today. This is how your minister came to be who he is, and it is good you know it. There is no way I'd be standing here today if it was not for that crucial, crazy passage of my life. The good news is that this church is still here. So am I. So are most of you. The hole I fell in, the woods I got lost in, wasn't an end. It wasn't the end. It wasn't even really a middle. It was late in life, a beginning of a new story that begins with surrender, a saying yes to meaningful connection with others, and commitment to value such wholeness, and to invite others into that holiness. And so may it be for all of us who make the spiritual journey down and in to get to that heroic yes. Amen.
We hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitarianessay@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching Essay Unitarians.